Welcome to Two Dope Boys in a Podcast. I'm Phil McKenzie.
I'm Michael Brooks.
On Point is where we highlight someone getting it right. And this week we're joined by the author of To Kill a City, Peter Moskowitz. He's got me all in my feelings. I'm very, you know, last week we talked about Drake. This week we're talking about gentrification. This has made me like 2 weeks of being very emotionally open.
Drake, you're wrong. You shouldn't be emotionally open because of Drake. But gentrification, you're right.
So,
absolutely.
So, Peter, thanks so much for joining us and jumping on with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I'm just going to get right into it because it's a book that, you know, from my perspective, it not only talked about gentrification in the usual ways in which we see it talked about in popular media as this individualized personal choice, hipster versus, you know, quote unquote, regular people way.
Right.
What really struck me was the way you got us away from that narrative, but also talked about race and class history as personified through the four cities that you chose to examine. Obviously, you could have looked at many others, but you captured four cities in particular, New Orleans, Detroit, San Francisco, and New York. So with that as a backdrop, let's just start from the very beginning. Like, how would you explain gentrification as how you've defined it in your work, How to Kill a City?
Right. I think, as you said, like all the kind of popular media descriptions of gentrification presented as this individual act, you know, hipster moving to a city or whatever, a new coffee shop opening in a neighborhood. And you know, as someone who grew up in New York and I'm white, some might call me a hipster, but who also so I felt like complicit in the process in a way, but also felt the victim of it because I couldn't afford to live in the neighborhood I grew up in or anywhere near it. I just knew it had to be something bigger than, you know, hipsters with mustaches or craft beer or whatever. So I really wanted to explore it. And that's kind of how I end up defining gentrification as not an individual process, but a top-down, state-sanctioned process of policy creation that essentially disadvantages low-income and middle-income people in favor of the rich. So I think that's the best way to think about gentrification, is this whole-scale change in the way cities operate from being kind of more classical, quote-unquote, welfare states where, you know, there's things like public education and public transit and taxes to pay for all those things, to this more, you know, hyper-capitalist trickle-down economy where the rich are courted to pay for everything that a city needs.
Yeah, and I think part of the other thing that you do in the book as well, and I want to be, you know, careful because I obviously, or, you know, maybe not too careful, but I think the second step, the first step is the sort of notion that you debunk that it's just this sort of individualized thing and hipsters move in and then, oh, whoa, all of a sudden these hipsters are moving in. Now there's just a new neighborhood. Hey, man, that's organic versus this very structured process you're talking about. There's also the other reality that there's a violence to it, that this isn't separable from all the other issues that are, you know, in the news. Policing, violence towards people of color, safety issue, you know. So what I'd like you to do is maybe get into the origins of that policy shift, the shift from the city as a welfare state, how we came to this new place. And then, you know, at least in New York, I would assume like there's also like the Giuliani story is the intersection of that because it's the brutality of the policing and the violence against communities of color combined with, we got to turn Times Square into a giant Applebee's.
Right. And please remind me to talk about policing if I forget at the end of what I'm about to say. But I think you're exactly right that it is tied into all these issues. So basically, we have to go back about 100 years to understand how this idea of gentrification first started. And New York is really ground zero when it comes to this policy planning. At the turn of the 20th century, a bunch of bankers, from banks that are still around, like J.P. Morgan, and real estate magnates and politicians got together, and they kind of saw the writing on the wall that industry was going to move down south, that it might eventually move overseas, that New York City might not be a manufacturing powerhouse forever. And so they created this plan to essentially turn Manhattan from a mixed use, industrial, commercial and residential place into essentially just high end residential and office space. And they, they wanted to do that obviously because that would benefit the real estate owners of Manhattan. So that came together as a plan in the early 1900s. And then the most powerful and rich New Yorkers essentially worked for the next 50 years to make sure that was a reality. At the same time, right after the Great Depression, the federal government was trying to figure out how do we restart the economy? And that's how the suburbs came into play. Before the Great Depression, there wasn't really such a thing as the suburbs. But after the Great Depression, the federal government got together with home builders and said, we need a way to jumpstart this economy. And also, if it happened to further segregate our society so that people of color and white people aren't mixing together and getting crazy ideas about, progressivism or overthrowing the government or anything like that, that would be a good side benefit to this project. And that sounds like a conspiracy, but it's well documented that these were the motives when people were thinking about the creation of the suburbs. So essentially what the federal government did was create an instrument, an insurance-backed mortgage, which we now think of as normal today, but was unheard of before then, and create maps of where these mortgages could be given out. And so if you've heard the term redlining, that's where it originates. They literally put red lines around neighborhoods that had any Black people, any Latino people, and sometimes any Jews in them. They put red lines around them and said banks shouldn't lend to these people. And so what that did was push all white people out to the suburbs, gave them mortgages so that they had something that they had to keep on paying and therefore wouldn't join in political activity as much as they might if they were renters in an urban center.
Right.
And it completely disinvested from the inner city. So you take that combined with this plan to completely deindustrialize a place like New York, and you get New York City in the 1970s, which was, nearly bankrupt. That was the quote unquote bad old days, the Bronx is burning and all that. And people kind of thought of that as some natural phenomenon. But it wasn't. It was this very purposeful policy shift. And sorry, I know I'm going on for a long time.
No problem. Yeah. So then there's the shift to the suburbs, and then I guess taking it more sort of forward and you can connect it with the policing. I know I gave you a lot, but that shift in the sort of modern iteration of what we understand of the gentrification now and how that was inseparable from Giuliani policing policies as an example. Or, sure. You can also expand it. I mean, New Orleans, what was the responses to post-Katrina, depending on what, neighborhood you were in?
Right. So if you start with that kind of turning point in the 1970s, when all cities had been kind of disinvested from, and once again, it was a purposeful disinvestment. It wasn't some natural phenomenon of white people all of a sudden getting together and deciding we should move out of here.
Let's go.
Right.
Yeah. So, that's the Mitt Romney voice. Yeah.
What disinvestment did was make real estate in the city extremely cheap. So now you have all these white people living in the suburbs with tremendous housing wealth, and you have a completely disinvested inner city. So where's the next logical move for real estate money to go? It's back to the city. It can't go in the suburbs anymore because you're getting commute times of an hour and a half. People are sick of suburban living, and all of a sudden you can buy a building in the East Village for, $10,000, or you can buy up an entire block of Crown Heights if you're a developer for not that much money. So gentrification just started to make economic sense. And once it started to make economic sense for developers, that's when politicians like Rudy Giuliani got on board. And, you know, I'm sure there's nothing in their policy documents that says let's police black neighborhoods so that people can buy these buildings and gentrify them. But it's pretty obvious, you know, if you look at policing patterns, if you look at the cleanup of Times Square, if you look at all these ways in which the city essentially decided to concentrate on policy in a way that would affect people of color disproportionately, it's obvious that the reason they did this was to attract wealth to certain neighborhoods in the city, and specifically white wealth to certain neighborhoods in the city. And, you know, there are studies that show as a neighborhood gentrifies, that's when its police presence increases. So it doesn't, policing and gentrification don't necessarily go hand in hand. You could theoretically just have a developer looking at a neighborhood and buying buildings there and not have a police presence increase. But if you look at politicians like Rudy Giuliani or Bloomberg or post Katrina in New Orleans, you know, and there are politicians there, these are all very development friendly governments. And what they want to do is make sure that if developers want to go into a certain neighborhood, that they're not going to have any concerns about it. So they might say that, you know, this increased police presence is for the people, for the people who live here, but really what it's for is for the people who are donating to these politicians who are dictating policy behind closed doors, and that would be developers. And even Bill de Blasio, who said, you know, he's kind of a champion of the poor, you know, almost every single one of his funders is a developer. Mm-hmm. So that kind of shows you who they're listening to.
And, you know, as I was reading the book, it really did trace a lot of things. Like, again, you know, as a native New Yorker, you know, I kind of lived through like everything you're talking about. And it's a very personal thing in the sense that, for example, when you were talking about, you know, there are two kind of concurrent thoughts. One is, as you were kind of describing growing up in the West Village and being able to go to school on your own at like 10 years old and walking to and from school and because you guys knew everybody along the route. Like if your parents were late, right, you stayed at the pizza place and you hung out, you know, because you knew the pizza guy, mm-hmm, and all that kind of stuff. And I grew up in Brownsville, Brooklyn until I was 13. Then my family moved to East Flatbush because we were able to buy a house. But mm-hmm, I always tell the story of my landlords were not adversarial in the way that people think about landlord relationships now. They were a Polish-Jewish family. The grandmother, the mother of the guy who ran the building, owned the building, Mrs. Scalas. I always reference them because, like, she took care of me and my sister in between that time when my dad wasn't home from work and my mom, who worked at night, went to work. So from mm-hmm 3 to mm-hmm 6, me and my sister stayed with Mrs. Scalas, and we did our homework at her table. She took care of us. There wasn't that idea of extracting every last penny that they could from my parents. Right. And that ultimately resulted in us being able to save enough money, my parents saving enough money to buy a home. And so when you were relaying your story about growing up in the West Village, it reminded me of my own story growing up in Brownsville, where my landlord was not my enemy. And
right,
and it made me think about, to kind of close the circle, and I highlighted this quote where you talked about Sarah Shulman, the writer, and this mm-hmm idea of the gentrification of the mind. And
right,
like, talk a little bit about that, because it dovetails a lot with me and Michael's work and thought about having every relationship shouldn't be a function of transaction or being a zero sum, meaning I win, you lose, or vice versa. And when you talked about this gentrification of the mind, it seemed like it paralleled a lot with that concept. Could you go into a little detail about that?
Sure. So, yeah, I mean, I think you're you're exactly right that what we're seeing is not just, you know, it's not just about like the remaking of cities, but the remaking of how we think of cities in relation to ourselves and even how we see ourselves as people. There's a lot of effort that gets put into reshaping how we think of our lives in cities when gentrification occurs. If you live in a condo complex in Williamsburg and, you know, go to the new taco joint where the people who run it are, you know, never there, but are some kind of, you know, high concept corporation or whatever. And, you know, you have a gym in your building and maybe a pool and all of that. Like, you're taught that everything you're doing is essentially a consumption-based experience. There's no room for community knowledge to grow. There's no room for informal connections. Sarah Schulman, who wrote The Gentrification of Mind, talks about how we have kind of taken a suburban mentality of individuality, of private property, and kind of transposed it on a city. And I feel that, you know, when I walk around the city these days, or I go to events or whatever, I look around me and I realize, wait, everyone here is from the same class. Everyone here is from the same race. Like, I didn't try to do this. I didn't, you know, seek this out. But just by how the city operates, we're now kind of pushed into these silos. And Samuel Delaney, another great author, talks about that in Times Square Red, Times Square Blue, about that seedier version of Times Square. You know, which people might find gross if they don't use it, but for queer people, for sex workers, for a whole variety of people, it was the only place they could go and where other people could go and kind of mix between race and class and have those kinds of chance interactions that you don't see so much in the city anymore. And I just find that really sad. I mean, that was the saddest part for me in writing the book, was realizing, oh shit, that city that I remember, that kind of like too good to be true neighborhood of, yeah, being able to walk home from school when I was 10 years old, it just doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, it's funny. Stephen Lewis, who's another one of our friends and sort of regular contributors on the show, is sort of an iconic figure in the development of New York nightlife. And he always talks about, you know, the club experiences he wanted to design, people would hit into each other. Like, there would be the, you know, the stockbroker from the Upper East Side, and there would be the, you know, someone who was, you know, organizing like a drag ball from the Village. Like, and, you know, that was the kind of spaces he wanted to create, even like just in nightclub life, like this very broad mixing, which is, you know, kind of urban life at its best in some ways. I guess I want to, you know, touch on a couple of other things, and maybe we could get to the response that you've gotten to this book, maybe mm-hmm. with some interviewers that are less enlightened than we are. but it seems to me that, you know, roughly speaking, kind of, you know, studying this stuff in the sort of past tense, at least, because I wasn't alive to these issues or in the city or thinking about them in the 1990s during, you know, Giuliani. And I had a sense, obviously I was in college. I remember when Katrina happened, looking at that fallout. But we've undergone, it seems like, a vague shift in how we talk about gentrification, which is in the sense that, you know, at least in New York, it was never a conversation other than, you know, this is a positive thing because now all these quote unquote, you know, bad neighborhoods are good now. Now, I want to, you know, of course, add the caveat that obviously, you know, crime getting lower and more, you know, shops being available, like, are desirable things, right? Like, in a just sort of clear, you know, so I don't want to kind of have a, you know, a reverse romanticism. But the reality was that while that discourse was happening, it was like, yes, because a lot of people of color and poor people are getting cleaned out of their neighborhoods. Now there's been this kind of broader conversation because now the cleansing sweep is, wait a second, I have a good job. I went to a good college. You know, what the fuck? I can't afford that place either. So that's creating a different set of conditions and conversations. But I guess I want you to talk to that, but I'm curious in terms of the kind of debris of the sort of generic, lazy march of progress discourse that we had before, yeah. as you've been kind of bringing this book out, do you still get the pushback of either like the fantasy scenarios of like, well, this all works out best for everybody at the end, or it's a, you know, it's a sacrifice for progress, or, you know, what's the kind of response been?
Yeah, so I think unfortunately that is still a very mainstream view, and not to be too cynical, but it's not until people actually start being personally affected by it that they realize, oh, right, maybe this isn't such a
maybe it doesn't all work out for the best.
Right.
When exactly. it's my apartment, so, right.
Right. So like if you go to New Orleans now or Detroit, which is still relatively affordable, especially if you're middle class and you're a gentrifier and are, you know, have kind of been welcomed to the city with open arms by developers and politicians, a lot of people there still think, you know, are still thinking maybe how New Yorkers thought 5 years ago or 10 years ago, like, oh, what's so bad about this? You know, this block was abandoned before and now there are new houses here. But if you go to New York and San Francisco, where rents are literally, you know, averaging, you know, $3,500 a month for a one bedroom, it's obvious to people who might have once thought this is an inherently good thing that there are consequences to the process of just allowing any kind of development without any halting to it, you know, kind of at all costs. So, yeah, I mean, I think in terms of response to my book, it kind of falls along those lines, unfortunately. I gave a talk at the New York Public Library a couple weeks ago, and, you know, I was excited about that talk and thought the book was received well, mostly because it was older New Yorkers there, and older New Yorkers are some of like the crankiest and best people in the world. But they all kind of got it, you know. They're like, right. "Yeah, like this sucks."
Yeah, it's been terrible, right?
It was the younger New Yorkers, the kind of wide-eyed, like, "I just moved here, and this is, you know, my dream home," yada yada, who needed to see something positive. I think almost in order to give meaning to their life. You know, if you move into one of these new buildings, or if you know you've been complicit in helping displace someone, you want to believe that you're not a bad person, and you want to believe that, you know, that there has to be a reason that this is happening beyond it's making someone a lot of money. So, you know, I'm hoping that the book can show people that, you know, while it's not necessarily their fault on an individual level, that they are part of this larger system that they have to be thinking about.
Well, and they've been trained in that mind shrinking you talked about before.
And that's a powerful thing. Right. I mean, I think that was one of the stronger elements, was this taking away this personal choice. I mean, I live in Fort Greene now, you know, and mm-hmm. I went to high school in Fort Greene in the 80s. You know, like that was not a sweet experience, but there were people like Spike Lee who built his home and built a business, and he was right across the street from my high school. And I think like those elements, and Spike Lee is someone who's vociferously argues against gentrification. He's like, right. all of these elements of, you know, better services, better police presence, those should have been there from the jump. Like it right. shouldn't have taken, you know, these right. new people who primarily don't look like the current people to make all these things happen. And the other right. the and other point real quick is like I saw a documentary called My Brooklyn, which mm-hmm. talks about the strip of Fulton Mall. And so many people think of gentrification as this you know, literally a white black issue. But I think what you've talked about is and we've had this debate in the studio is that it's really an issue not just of race, black and white, but of economics. And My Brooklyn talked about like a lot of the shop owners along Fulton Mall that were they were Asian and South Asian, and they built mm-hmm. their businesses catering to communities that could afford to buy what they were selling. And then they were displaced right. now for Abercrombie and Fitch and right. Swarovski and all these other things, and now where are they gonna go as business owners?
Right.
You know.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. So I think just to speak to that, like, first of all, yeah. I mean, why weren't all these services here before? but also why are all these services synonymous with displacement? Like if in an ideal world, having things like clean streets or a safe neighborhood wouldn't mean only rich people can afford to live in that neighborhood. But that I think gets to the second point, which you were just mentioning. Gentrification kind of puts the squeeze on everyone. And there's this woman in New Orleans who I talked to for the book named Ruth Idakola, and she's an activist who kind of had to claw her way back to the city after Katrina, after the city essentially did everything it could to not let people like her back in. And she gave me this metaphor that I keep thinking about, to think of gentrification as turning cities into ladders, and everyone is kind of on a rung, you know. So if you grew up poor and you're a person of color, like, you might be on the bottom rung of that ladder. You have the least housing wealth, you have the least security in terms of, you know, who's gonna, if the city's gonna have your back if something goes wrong. But everyone is on a rung. So, you know, yeah, the immigrant shop owners who are catering to people who can afford their goods might be a little bit on a higher rung, but gentrification pushes them down too. And so everyone's kept pushed, squeezed and squeezed until some people are pushed off completely.
You know, can we get to a space where once we move away from the individual choice, we get to things being more systemic? I think about, for example, Barcelona, you know, it's one of my favorite cities, and they've pushed back against Airbnb. They push back against tourists coming to the city, like this idea of people coming in with day passes and, you know, they're making that cheap. They've made it more expensive in a weird way to sort of dissuade transient people. Like, it sounds, it sounds weird, but it sounds like, it seems like they are making a choice to make a livable city for, you know, Catalans, people who are from Barcelona, as opposed to just catering to developers and anyone and everyone who can pay the highest point. Do you see a future like that here in New York, at least, or anywhere else in the United States that you've seen?
Yeah, I mean, I do see a future where that's possible, especially in New York and maybe San Francisco, where we've seen all the negative effects of gentrification and where we're kind of at like a peak right now. You know, neighborhoods are still going through, but it's not going to be what we saw over the next 20, 30, or over the last 20, 30 years, I don't think. But I think the problem is that we don't think of housing or where we live as political for some reason. Like the presidential debates, who mentioned housing, even though it's our number one cost of living expense? Who mentioned housing, even though there's a housing crisis in this country right now, and people are spending more and more on their homes and on rent? We just kind of think of housing as, you know, this is, you know, something we have to pay. But we don't fight it. We don't fight for it like we fight for food justice. We don't fight for it like we fight for anti-poverty programs. And so I think this is a long-term thing that needs to happen, a long-term shift in how we think about where we live as something political and not just an individual choice or a matter of whatever circumstance we might happen to be in. But I am encouraged, you know, like seeing people in New York, you know, fighting grassroots fights and sometimes winning. There are great groups in almost every neighborhood fighting against new development. There was a small protest in Flatbush the other week that saved this old Caribbean bakery from being shut down and their rent increased. And it's fights like that that give me hope. More than anything happening in politics right now, because as I said, even Bill de Blasio, you know, he's still funded by developers. His housing person is Alicia Glenn, who came from Goldman Sachs. So I don't think she's going to be, you know, necessarily on board with, you know, rent control or anything like that.
The policy approach, as far as I understand, that people like de Blasio are pushing, which is better than Bloomberg, but it's basically just keep being incredibly generous to the developers. Don't solve any of the issues structurally, but what you do is you just start to, you know, you just mandate, like, okay, you'll have that development, but, you know, 10% of those homes need to be quote-unquote affordable, which, you know, is a whole other sort of wonky metrics, and that gets into all sorts of other like overly complicated means testing things. So that's, right. I mean, it's, you know, it's a modest improvement over what was before, but it's obviously not a solution. So I guess, I mean, just to really underline that, if we're looking for solutions to this, there's the sort of like just reality that it can't go much further in some ways, just literally economically, and then just getting really back on the streets to actually organize. Exactly. Right.
Yeah. I mean, and in some ways the city is in a bind because the state controls things like rent control, but you're not even seeing politicians argue for things like rent control. You're not even, the agenda, you know, yeah. You're like back when the original round of rent control was passed, I could actually do more research into this, but it'd be fascinating how there was enough momentum to actually make that happen. You know, it would be fascinating to know how that was possible. And now, you know, you hear nothing about it from anyone. All you hear is, yeah, these kind of technocratic, developer-friendly solutions that get you kind of 10% of the way there, maybe, but or 1% of the way there, but aren't nearly enough. So I think we have to stop relying on politicians like Bill de Blasio who kind of present this progressive vision without backing it up and start thinking about more grassroots activism to push for these more ambitious goals.
You know, one of the things you talk about, and I think we're going to go out on this, you talk about these shock events, shock doctrines, Katrina being a catalyst for people to enact social policy to move poor people, people of color out of the city, or when the event happens, they just make it incredibly difficult toward them coming back so they can wipe the slate clean over a bunch of different things. The New York City bankruptcy in the 1970s being another one of these shock doctrine catalysts. Detroit probably having mini shocks all along for 50 years. Maybe I'm alone in this, but I'm kind of hoping that we get a shock doctrine the other way. Like 2008, we had a shot and we blew it. Maybe the Dow gets cut in half and we go in another fucking direction.
Yeah.
Am I hopeless? Am I lost in that?
I don't think you're wrong. I don't want to be an accelerationist. Like, I obviously don't think it's a good thing Trump got elected. But I've been out in the streets more. I've been more politically active. I've been seeing friends who used to not care about anything suddenly care. In New York, now that, you know, hardly anyone can afford to comfortably live there, like, maybe we do have an opportunity for people to just wake up and be like, wait, what's going on? You know, we have this proto-fascist president. My rent is too expensive. everything that I thought was, you know, kind of like would work itself out or go in this generally progressive direction over many decades, it's not happening, you know? So maybe that will be the shock we need to say, hey, let's actually figure out a solution to this.
I'm definitely not an accelerationist either. But I will say that, and this is not a good thing. Like we're not advancing because we're fighting something that was horrific, but I will say just in terms of the activity, I didn't expect to be shutting down JFK a couple of months ago. That was not something that I planned on doing. I didn't expect to be in a frigid temperature in the middle of an arrivals gate at JFK being like, fuck no. So that is a different energy, no doubt about it. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, brother. This is really good. And I'm being really serious. Like the book really, really touched me. Like a lot of the stories, you know, I've talked about these things and raged against them. Like I've experienced it with all the projects going on in Brooklyn. You know, I lost the art space to what's now a 40, 45 story building with a, that I just can't even bear. Every day I walk past it, it reminds me of what I wanted to do as compared to what's standing there now. So it's now a new Ashland property with all this kind of stuff.
New and garbage, yeah.
So it was a very personal experience for me over these last few days reading your book. So thank you for being a little bit of therapy and for writing this. And I really, really enjoyed it as one New Yorker to another.
Peter Moskowitz, How to Kill a City, Gentrification, Inequality, and the Fight for the Neighborhood. Thank you so much for joining On Point.
Thank you, Bo.